WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Promises, promises. Barack Obama made tons of them during the last presidential campaign. Mitt Romney is making them now. All office seekers make promises. Some are kept, some are not. Because of the state of the economy, the presidential candidates are talking about jobs and how they will create them, about taxes and how to adjust them, about government and how to fix it, and on and on. But just what can a president really do about such things? What can he not do? How much does the winner of the highest office in the land really impact the fate of the nation in the long or short term? We talk about that this hour with Dr. Scott Huffman, John Schmier, and Mark Kelso. Scott Huffman is a professor of political science and founder and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory at Winthrop University. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
John Schmier is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Good to see you again as well.
Great to be here.
And Mark Kelso is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Studies at Queen's University of Charlotte. And nice to have you with us again as well.
Thank you.
At the top of the list of powers granted to the president as enumerated by the Constitution is that of Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy. Somehow they left out the Air Force. And other various state militias and the power to grant pardons. What other powers are stated in the Constitution that the president can do? What does he have? What powers does he have? John.
The power to appoint ambassadors, which is another one of the foreign affairs powers, the power to appoint judges. And both of them, though, with the consent of the Senate. So this isn't a unilateral power. Then also the other, probably one of the most important powers, the power to propose legislation. People think that we have a separation of powers. It's not true. It's shared. And the president plays a large role in the legislative process.
So in terms of the way the presidency was designed by the founding fathers, not the way it's practiced today, but the way it was designed, how would you assess the power of the presidency?
I think up until the 1930s, it was a relatively weak office. I mean, if you look at the history of the presidency, it was only during times of crisis, such as the Civil War, or times when you had a very big personality, such as an Andrew Jackson or a Theodore Roosevelt, that the presidency really kind of went to the top of the power structure in American politics. That all changed in the 1930s, and we can talk about that in a bit.
Okay, and we will, because that...
The argument is that now, after that, and it was, you know, relatively limited before, but now, you know, presidential power is vast, but as John points out, its grasp on it can be tenuous because it is truly shared. And that's, you know, the true separation of powers. But in modern times, the argument, as you see in the Constitution, where it says executive power shall be granted to a president, the definition of that term executive power has been expanded and debated from the 1930s on. Mm-hmm. And some people have argued executive powers are so broad, they're virtually king-like. And others have said, no, they're strictly almost just administrative. And that's one of the debates.
And how much of the justification for the increase in power of the office of the president has to do with the fact that he is the only official elected by everybody in the land?
Well, with the Electoral College, he's...
Not even...
I think a lot of that is... It's true that we're the president's the primary focus of the people. Mm-hmm. And we don't spend enough time on politics to focus on 535 members of Congress. We have just enough time to focus on what the president's doing. And the president gets a larger media voice. They have more media opportunities. And so they get to communicate directly to us. And, yes, we all have a sense of that we play a role, at least those of us that vote, in who the president is.
Well, I would part of it, I think, is the people focus so much on the president because we have an almost unique institution in that we both are head of state and our head of government is the same person. So many countries have a separate head of state who is symbolic. You know, the Queen's the head of state of Britain and Canada and Australia, but there's a separate head of government. So we are electing not just the person who is our most political person ever in the country at the time. We're also electing the person who's supposed to be above politics and the symbol of the country. And so I think Americans are, you know, partially politically schizophrenic, especially about the presidency, because of that duality of what we've created in the Constitution.
There are a lot of people who like to literally interpret the Constitution and pick at every little word and every little phrase and the order in which they were put in. So at the top of the list is commander-in-chief and the power to grant pardons. Why do you suppose that is at the top of the list of powers?
Well, because it's very expansive power, especially, you know, we haven't had a declaration of war since, 1941.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that power that the Congress to declare war that is not given to the president is almost meaningless. And there's a number of reasons for that. I think, first of all, the nature of war has changed. You don't see state-to-state conflict like you did back in that earlier time.
Mm-hmm.
But the president de facto has now the power to engage us in military conflicts and even, what for all practical purposes are wars, large-scale wars, without having the necessity of going to Congress. So that is an extremely expansive power that the president has kind of taken on in the last few decades.
Do you want to go ahead?
Well, I was just going to add to that. I think it's true. One of the facts that always astounds my students, we've sent troops into conflict more than 200 times with only 5 official declarations of war. And a lot of that has to do with the expansion of the commander-in-chief power. And I think it was there first because the one power that everybody then and now agrees that the federal government should have
mm-hmm.
is the power to protect the country
right.
from other nations.
Of those 200 times, how many were after World War II? There's Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iraq won. How many more?
Grenada.
I forgot about Grenada.
We sent a troop to Panama.
Wow, okay.
There are several others, actually.
And if you're in the military community, I was growing up in Fayetteville when Grenada happened, and all of a sudden everybody's dad just disappeared. And you never knew what was happening. So they have a huge impact. We often forget about these engagements because they don't seem big, but they have a big impact in the community.
The power to tax, the power to coin money, the power to borrow money, to regulate commerce, to grant patents and copyrights, to declare war, all rest with Congress. And yet presidential candidates campaign on monetary issues, the national debt. They rail about putting troops in and pulling them out of various conflicts. How did we get here? It seems like the president runs on all the things that Congress ultimately has to do.
Well, part of the president's ability to handle the budget has changed over time. Initially, none of those powers went to the president. It was all, spending bills must still originate in the House of Representatives. But after World War I, our budget was kind of a mess, and nobody knew exactly how much money had been spent. And, you don't really get reelected by being in a little accountant tallying how much money was spent. So they shifted that power to the president. The Budget and Accounting Act of 1921 gave a ton of power to the president to recommend a budget, and whoever has the power to design the budget, even though it still must all be passed in its entirety by Congress, the president now designs the budget and supposed to reconcile the budget
mm-hmm.
And go forward. And as far as employment, the Employment Act 1946, after World War II, gave the power he was supposed to make recommendations for full employment. Is that how the language went for that? Which gave him more influence in the economy than he had prior to that. So there has been a little bit of gain in presidential power in that area in the 20th century.
In several recent, not too distant past elections, we heard the candidates talking about asking Congress for the line item veto for the budget, because the president proposes the budget and the Congress has to pass it in total, but the president would like the power, at least previous presidents and candidates wanted the power, to say, no, not that, out. We don't hear anything about that anymore. Why not?
It's unconstitutional. The Congress tried to do it in the 90s. They passed it.
Yeah,
90s the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional.
In 96, and it was declared unconstitutional in 97. They finally got it. Mm-hmm. You got it. Here it is. And Clinton used it once, an immediate injunction.
Well, in fact, they challenged it before it had even even had the power. There were two interest groups that challenged it before he even had the power. The Supreme Court said that they didn't have it wasn't a ripe dispute at that point. And then they challenged it again after he used it twice the two different groups that were impacted by it, and it was declared unconstitutional very quickly.
So literally have to change the Constitution now to get that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mark?
I think the other issue is that even if the president had it, it wouldn't make all that much difference. I think what is not commonly understood by the American voter is how much of our budget is simply stuff you can't really touch. Mm-hmm. You have Medicare, Social Security, interest on the debt, and defense, which make up, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70-75% of the budget. There's only maybe a quarter there that you can actually touch that is discretionary. So even if, you know, a president used a line item veto to completely devastate the discretionary spending, you're still talking huge amounts of money being spent.
But if the president is the commander-in-chief and he's in charge of the armed services and therefore the budget, that's a lot of money he controls, or she controls, if it ever comes to that. I want to get back to something you brought up, Markell, so, and that is the exponential growth in power of the presidency beginning in the 1930s. Was it just Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the power of his personality, or was it the fact that we were in the Great Depression and we moved into World War II, and we needed a focal point to get us out of the Great Depression and also conduct this massive war?
Mm-hmm. I think it was the crisis situation combined with, you know, another point that's been brought up, you know, the sharing of power. Franklin Delano Roosevelt comes into office in 1933 with huge majorities in the House and Senate, so he can get almost anything he wants. And I think it was a response to the crisis, but that set us on the path of growing government. You know, government is now seen as, you know, an actor when it's a crisis situation. And we saw that with the Great Depression. We saw that with World War II, of course. Then we saw it in the Civil Rights Movement. And, you know, we continue to see that. And I think that's one of the things, as government grows, because the president is kind of seen as the key player in that. You know, Congress does play an important role, but the president is often seen as the one who must address the crisis situations, et cetera. So I think really there are three things at work there. It was the growth of government brought on by the crisis, the rise of the electronic media, which we already talked about, and then thirdly, the rise of the U.S. as a world power after World War II.
We never used the term electronic media, but radio came in concurrently with Roosevelt, the Great Depression, the fireside chats, and the Second World War, and then it grew into television, and it seems to me that played a big role as well.
Well, and a lot of it interrelates. So you also have the strong personality. Mm-hmm. It's not just the fact that we're in a crisis. It's not just the fact that Congress is, you know, he has an overwhelming majority of Democrats in office. It's not just that he has the media. It's the fact that FDR was a force of nature. He used the media effectively.
Right.
And when he didn't have an institution that was on his side, he used brute force and threats.
Right.
The Supreme Court's blocking most of his regulations. Most of those expansions of government that we now take for granted, the Supreme Court blocked until 1938 when FDR threatened to increase the size of the court.
Well, we're told that LBJ did something similar to that because he grew out of the Congress. He was very powerful in the Senate, and he used the bully pulpit and the big stick behind the scenes. We've heard the recordings of the telephone calls. Have other presidents beyond LBJ done this? Did Reagan do it? Has Obama done it? Did Clinton do it? Did Bush do it?
I think there's somewhat of a myth that it's just this incredible personality and energetic president can just move mountains. You have to remember, LBJ was in the very same situation that FDR was. He had overwhelming majorities after the 1964 election. So
his issue was actually moving people from his own party, because you had the dichotomy in the Democratic Party between the Southern Democrats and the rest of the Democrats,
right.
And he was actually trying to coerce his fellow Southern Democrats.
Civil rights was not an easy issue, and he knew he was losing the South to the Republicans as a result of it. I mean, how did he manage that?
Again, by, you know, having the majority and being able to, within the party, use a little bit of the kind of the carrot and the stick approach. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember, we can't just attribute growth in presidential power to strong presidential personalities, because every one of these people woke up and wanted to be leader of the free world.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and more and talk about presidential power, what presidents can and cannot do. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and CPCC's Corporate Learning Center, hosting Advantage Series Talent Management for Success on October 31st at the Harris Conference Center. Details at cpcc.edu/CLC. And the U.S. National Whitewater Center, pairing outdoor activities, live Americana music, and special events, open year-round in Charlotte. Information at usnwc.org. Well, for decades, many Western nations have splurged. The result is the accumulation of massive amounts of debt, for which the bill has now come due, and that has caused a financial crisis. And we're told this country is on the same path. But Philip Coggan says the world has been here many times before. A columnist for The Economist and author of Paper Promises, Money, Debt, and the New World Order, he talks about the history of debt and its repetitive pattern tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, voters look to political polls to understand who's winning the presidential race. But interpreting these numbers can be difficult. The art and science of political polls.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with three political scientists, Dr. Mark Kelso, Professor Chair of Political Science and International Studies at Queen's University of Charlotte, Dr. John Schmier, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Scott Hoffman, Political Science Professor at Winthrop University. A president can either sign or veto bills passed by Congress. Where's that in the Constitution?
Well, actually, there's a third option. The president cannot sign
the legislation
as well. And depending on the timing, that can actually have the force of a veto.
Is that the pocket veto?
Yes.
Yeah, but and I tell my students, you know, you can do nothing and you've done nothing. The president can do nothing, and it depends on when he did nothing as to whether or not he did nothing, because at the end of the session, it's a pocket veto. If it's not at the end of the session, it becomes law without his signature.
Is that in the Constitution?
It says that if you issue a veto, you must send a report back to Congress, and if they have adjourned, there's no Congress to send the report back to.
And in recent years, we have been hearing about these so-called signing statements. I believe President Bush did this a lot, and I believe President Obama has done it more than once.
Almost all presidents have issued signing statements.
Really?
Virtually all.
Why have we just heard about this, and where is that in the Constitution, that the president can sign a law that Congress has passed, but put provisions on it as to how his administration will act on it?
Arguably, it's implied in the executive power. One of the primary grants to the president is that they're the chief executive. And so the president can interpret for the members of the executive branch what he believes the law means. And so essentially a signing statement is saying, well, I believe that it meant this, but it didn't mean that.
And remember, he's charged with enforcing the law. Congress makes the law. The president is supposed to enforce it as the executive. So a signing statement is essentially saying this is how this is to be enforced or not be enforced. And, you know, they came up, I think, politically during President George W. Bush's tenure, because he had issued so many more than all of his predecessors combined, depending on how you measured it. 161 signing statements, which was not a huge number ahead, but it affected 1,100 provisions of law, which was way more than any others. Obama has used it 20 times. Obama campaigned bashing President Bush's use of the signing statement and immediately came into office and started using them. So this is, you know, when people run for the president, especially when they're in Congress, they think presidential power needs to be reined in. The millisecond they become president, I think they have a very different view of the scope
of it. Explain that, because people are confused by that. Why is it simply that you suddenly see what has to be done because you're giving all these briefings that you never got before and you're seeing the bigger picture? Or is it because you're in the big house and you got the desk in the Oval Office, and by God, I'm going to use it?
I think it's both. I mean, you do see the job differently when you see its full scope. But also remember, you know, these are all people who say, I'm the one who needs to be running the most powerful office in the free world, and I'm going to get in here and use these powers for good rather than my predecessor used them for evil. I think it's a combination.
So this is what we call checks and balances, all these things we've been talking about here. A president cannot declare war. Let's get back to this. This is a big one. A president cannot declare war. He can ask for a declaration of war, but Congress has to declare war. And yet, since World War II, we've been to Korea and all those places we talked about. Congress has been and never declared war. Never. Congress has debated the wisdom of some of these conflicts. They've urged greater or lesser involvement in these conflicts. They've urged greater or lesser money being devoted to these conflicts. But it is the president who decided to enter all of these conflicts and send troops into combat. How did the power of making war, because that's what this is, I don't care what you call it, it's war. How did, and we call it war, we call the war in Afghanistan a war. How did it shift to the president? Why has Congress abdicated this power, which is enormous?
Well, going back to something I said earlier, I think the starting point is state-to-state war in the modern world is just almost obsolete.
So I what? Mean, it's still war.
Well, it's but declaring
we
war on a
country. We toppled Saddam Hussein. Well, we did. We went in and toppled a dictator.
Well, we're declaring war on a country, when Japan invades us, we can declare war on Japan. When 9/11 happened, there wasn't a clear state to declare war on. So yeah,
but if
the nature of the conflict.
On. If you go in to Iraq and you with an explicit purpose to remove the leader, that's not war?
It is war, but I'm just saying that in terms of the way the founders conceptualized war, it was a state-to-state
thing.
Well,
that wasn't a war against the state of Iraq?
Well, they had not invaded us. You know, you're exactly right. You're a war in a practical sense, yes. What I'm saying is war in terms of the way our founders thought of it when they wrote that, they were thinking of a state-to-state
And the president does have the right to call out the military to defend the nation from attack. Is that how we got away with it in Iraq?
No. I think this happened before war changed, right? We're talking about conflicts that are 200 years old where the president didn't ask for authority from Congress and sent troops into foreign lands. It's partly this idea that the Congress has just generally given power to the president over time. But it's also partly this recognition that and particularly now with respect to technology, the president's better suited to deal with war. The president can react quickly. Congress cannot do anything quickly.
Right. And well, war, they can't do anything to stop there.
War even – well, there's now – there's no need to finish the sentence. But at this point, wars can start instantaneously. A nuclear sub can be – right. Off the coast and can attack the Capitol in minutes. And Congress can't react to that. Only the president can.
Well, no. And the president has the power in the Constitution to call the military to defend the nation from attack. So if a missile is headed our way, he has the power in the Constitution to launch a counterattack or put our troops into whatever they need to do that. But to do a long-scale 10-year war in Afghanistan – why isn't the Congress involved in declaring that a war?
Well, this hasn't been completely uncontroversial, this giving up power. I mean, remember that Congress tried to essentially end Vietnam by cutting off funding, and Johnson continued the war via his veto power. And so after Vietnam, we had the War Powers Act, which says the president can't go anywhere and essentially have a war without congressional approval. He has to get a congressional approval within 90 days, whether it's declared or not. Now, whether or not that's actually constitutional will never be tested.
And that's supposed to balance things. It's supposed to balance this idea that the president can react, send troops into foreign lands, and has a couple of months to do it or 3 months to do it. But then the Congress can make the more reasoned decision about whether we need to keep the troops deployed for longer periods.
And in Iraq, they got permission to go in before they went in, and that was the resolution. If Saddam Hussein doesn't act reasonably, we might go in. Will you give us the authority? And Congress said yes, and then all of a sudden he's nuts, we're going in. And so they had the resolution to give him permission to go in before they actually even went
in.
So
could it be argued that this is the largest, most important power the president has, and almost every president in modern history has exercised it?
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree.
And it's ever evolving because, as we see acts of what could arguably be deemed acts of war that involve zero boots on the ground, And a lot of it being pushed within the intelligence community. This is ever-evolving and will continue to do so.
And I think it's a dangerous situation, too, because if you take the case of Iraq, you know, preemptive strike, you know, how does that square with the language of the Constitution? I mean, you're taking a pretty broad interpretation there. So
that's the Bush doctrine that Sarah
Bush
Palin didn't know anything about.
Preemptive strike. I mean, the Constitution says you respond to an attack, but here you're saying we're going to respond to an attack that hasn't happened yet.
Right.
So it's kind of dangerous for any president to be given kind of too much interpretation here.
And to build on what Scott said, drone strikes as well. When you have technology where we can have no human costs, it makes it that much easier for presidents to expand the power or usage of the power.
We have also taken to doing things. I guess other leaders of other nations down through history have certainly done this, but we've also taken to doing surgical strikes like taking out Osama bin Laden. Now, it was no secret that that was our goal when we went to Afghanistan and that our goal was to kill this man or capture him and bring him back. But to do this, we went into a nation with which we are not at war, Pakistan. That gets a little fuzzy too. Is the power to do that, to go into a foreign country with which we are not at war, is that somewhere in the Constitution, or could that be challenged by somebody if they wanted to?
That would fall under the sovereignty of other nations, and you know there could be huge protests. We protest you coming in
right.
the United Nations, but that's about it. As far as presidential power, he can argue that it's within his duty as commander-in-chief to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, anytime you have an act of war or a military aggression, it's going to be violating some sovereign country's borders. Mm-hmm. But we're not the only country that does that. I think the French Special Forces have for decades been extremely good at these type of little surgical strikes, especially at terrorist camps in parts of Africa that maybe we just don't hear about that mm-hmm. often. But we're not the only country that does that.
A president cannot decide how federal money will be spent in the broad strokes. He can ask Congress for the money, but the Congress has to make that decision because, as we've said, they hold the purse strings. How has it evolved that Congress people attack the president of the opposite party usually for the financial state of the country when the Congress holds the purse strings, particularly when it comes to federal spending?
Yeah, I mean there's a large amount of irony there. you know, I mean, and again, you know, it crosses the party lines and you know, you can talk about during the Bush administration how certain things were passed, such as, you know, Medicaid drug benefit and things like that were never paid for and things like that. But, you know, that's one of the weird things, I think, in this election. Why is President Obama being held responsible, whereas the Congress largely is not?
And Congress, you're right, they do tacitly sign off on this. And, of course, the past few years, nobody signed off on it. We've just had continuing resolutions, and we actually don't have a budget. But the reason the president gets blamed, I think, is he does design the budget. It does have to be approved by Congress. But the budget and the 13 budget measures now come from the office of the president.
But can't the Congress say no?
They can, but it's very difficult to go back in and extract them, and that becomes a huge fight they don't necessarily want to get into. But, yes, they're culpable. And they're very culpable in
and
this.
And the purse strings are held in the House of Representatives,
officially,
which is a Republican-held body.
Which is why no budget's been passed. In the past, they've only passed continuing resolutions to avoid shutdowns.
And the absurdity goes even farther. It goes back to Mark's point. It's about 75% of this money was locked in by prior Congresses and prior presidents.
Which would be Republican presidents, but a Democratic Congress, because
and Democratic presidents with Democratic Congresses, and
goes back that far.
Yeah,
okay. A president can nominate ambassadors and receive representatives from other countries, but when did the executive branch become the arbiter of foreign policy? Is that spelled out in the Constitution? Is it something that's evolved over time because of ease and necessity of our ever shrinking world?
He is the head of state, and so I think with that comes a lot of foreign policy powers. In fact, the ability to recognize foreign countries really wasn't in there. George Washington did that because it said he can receive ambassadors. If you receive an ambassador from a new country, you have officially recognized them. So the Constitution didn't literally say the president has exactly that power, but it does say he can receive ambassadors. And George Washington jumped right into it and said, well, okay, then I officially recognize this nation. Mm-hmm. So every president, this is a document of brevity. It is also the Constitution. It is also a document of incredible compromise. This was not people taking their ideologies and chiseling them in stone. This is people horse trading over a lot of big issues. And the entire document is one of compromise. It's very brief. Compare it to the EU Constitution. I mean, you know, it's which is a book. Until Georgia rewrote their state constitution a few years back, it was thicker than the book Gone with the Wind. So the U.S. Constitution is a document of brevity, which means every person who acts upon a power alluded to in that constitution must in some way interpret it, and that evolves over the years.
So when we talk about the expansion of presidential power, particularly since the 1930s, are we talking about an expansion, a power grab, or are we talking about simply a recrafting, a remolding of the powers that were already there? You just decide to take this one but not that one.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there was some precedent in earlier presidents. As I mentioned Andrew Jackson before. Mm-hmm. Certainly he took the reins of power, and if people didn't like it, you know, he famously said to John Marshall, Supreme Court, I don't like your decision. I'm not going to enforce it. And Teddy Roosevelt was another one. So there were some precedents before. But I think what's different since the 1930s is, as somebody just said a little bit ago, every president now has this power, regardless of personality, regardless of how strong or weak they are politically. They inherit the leadership of the free world. They inherit the commander-in-chief role. They inherit the budgetary powers. So I think that's what's different now. Whoever gets into that office now has this array of powers. It is limited, though. And, you know, one of the things that I think is kind of intriguing now, if Mitt Romney does pull this thing out, he may be facing a Democratic Senate, and we may have the same kind of gridlock in a Romney administration that we've had in the last 2 years of the Obama administration.
We have a couple of email comments that have come in during this conversation. A fellow who identifies himself simply as Murr, M-U-R-R. Unfortunately, I'm not able to call in while I'm at work. I hope you will discuss the longevity of executive orders. As a rule, can a new president undo something that was done by the wave of another president's pen? I know that presidents can unilaterally withdraw from treaties. Future presidents can't undo a summary execution by predator strike. Can a future president undo a national monument status executive order which restricts the use of federal lands?
So implied in that is the fact that the president has the power to create executive orders, and it can be an incredibly powerful tool. It's the power to tell the executive branch what to do. And some of the most important acts in the last 100 years have been by executive order. Probably the classic one, Truman integrating the military. One of the first steps towards integration was done by executive order.
And don't ask, don't tell. Removal of it.
Exactly.
And,
well,
and the implementation
and
of it.
And obviously that's a great example of the fact that the president can in fact repeal a previous executive order just of his own presidency or another presidency.
And you can sell federal land that were previously declared sanctuary, those can be sold. So you can undo with a stroke of a pen what was done with the stroke of a pen if your political environment allows it.
Vince in Charlotte writes, I'm a former student of Dr. Kelso. In the last debate, President Obama briefly touched on his power to fill vacancies on the Supreme Court in what would be his second term. Could your guests elaborate on the significance of executive powers to appoint justices to the Supreme Court, and how could the outcome of the 2012 election shift the direction of the court? Aside from the power to make war, isn't this the place where the president has has the potential for his longest lasting impact?
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And before I get to Supreme Court, I'd like to make the point is that we often focus a little too much on the Supreme Court. It's really at the lower courts where the president, the federal district court and the courts of appeals, where the president, if say they serve two terms, they might have the power to appoint over half of those judges.
And didn't the Republicans keep a lot of Clinton appointee judges out?
Well, it's been happening for the last
over
several terms.
50. Yeah. And then the Democrats kept somewhere between 6 and 10 Bush judges, depending on how you define kept them from.
So is this a way for the legislative and the executive branch to acknowledge that the judicial branch is the strongest branch of government?
It's not that. I think it's more of an issue of the fact that the legacy lives beyond the elected officials. So the average term could be over 30 years now.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our conversation about what presidents can and cannot do on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Christoph Perrick returns to conduct Smetana's powerful Moldau and Schumann's Symphony No. 1, November 2nd and 3rd in the Belk Theater. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. And Heath Springs Residential Care Center, providing family-oriented long-term assisted living for the elderly in historic Heath Springs, South Carolina, for almost 20 years. Details at heathspringsrcc.com. Voters look to political polls to understand who's winning the presidential race, but interpreting those numbers can be difficult, and Diane Rehm and her guests will explore the art and science of political polls. Couldn't we wait till the day after Election Day to find out who won? Do we have to keep handicapping these things? That's coming up in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation about what presidents can and can't do, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
President Barack Obama and Republican nominee Mitt Romney have faced off in two debates. Their final matchup comes just 2 weeks before Election Day, as the last undecided voters are making up their minds. Some of those voters are in the coveted swing state of Florida, where the two candidates will meet tonight to debate foreign policy. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for special coverage of the third presidential debate from NPR News.
It's later tonight, starting at 9 at 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Dr. John Schmier, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Mark Kelso, Professor and Chair of Political Science at International Studies at Queen's University of Charlotte, and Dr. Scott Huffman, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Social and Behavioral Research Lab at Winthrop University, about presidential power, how it ebbs and flows. Does it ebb? I'm not sure it does. And we were talking about the power of the president to appoint justices to the Supreme Court, or at least nominate justices. They have to be approved by Congress. But it isn't just the Supreme Court. It's the lower federal courts as well. And all three of you were talking in the break about how during recent presidencies, a lot of these federal judicial positions are vacant because the Congress simply will not pass the nominations of the various presidents. Is this relatively modern, something a modern development?
Very modern. It used to be that unless somebody was, you know, completely incompetent or was perhaps so ideological on one side or the other that they just couldn't appoint, you know, couldn't approve them. Most judges got through. I think I would date it back to the Robert Bork nomination back in the 1980s, where that failed largely because of ideological grounds, and that just kind of set off a war that we've been fighting for the past 25 years.
So historically, there have been contentious debates over Supreme Court nominees going back since almost the beginning. Things started kicking up in the late 60s. Then it really started getting inflamed in the 80s with the Bork nomination. What you saw there was the growth of the involvement of interest groups, particularly at that point, liberal interest groups blocking what they thought was an overly conservative nominee. Mm-hmm. Then you see, since then, this rise of interest groups on both sides of the ideological aisle fighting judicial nominations. There are more than a dozen interest groups in D.C. whose sole goal is to fight judicial nominations, depending on which side is making them. And so then the battle expands from the Supreme Court nominees, which are fairly rare. Sometimes we can go more than a decade without a nomination, to the lower court nominations, where, you know, we have more than 10 times as many lower court or just court of appeals judges, let alone district court judges. And so the fight is expanded.
And how do these special interest groups wield their power? How do they get the attention of either the Congress or the president? How do they do it?
So they start with, you know, they're sort of grassroots from the members. Then they gain large memberships. Then they go through the media sources and then they had gained lobbying power over time. And it's not at the level of the NRA, but some of these groups like the American Center for Law and Justice, they have the ear of significant members in the Senate. And it doesn't take much. You need one person from the state of the vacancy for the lower courts just to essentially sign something called a blue slip, and that can block the nomination. One person.
And it's – you know, and so they – by being a central source of information, they make themselves important before they even talk about dealing in money. We always, you know, associate lobbying with money and the ability to bundle. But by becoming a central clearinghouse for information, all of a sudden somebody says, well, you know, what do we know about this person being nominated? And there's one entity that says, well, I happen to have a stack of information right here. Mm-hmm. And they become important on the base of knowledge alone before you even talk about bundling checks and anything else that interest groups.
The other thing, though, is judges play a role, more of a role than the president, in some of the more important social issues like abortion, gay rights. And so those issues, which involve the judges, also tap into the issues that many of the voters care about.
Right. But when we go to the ballot box and when we watch these debates, we don't generally think a lot or talk a lot about the president's power to appoint Supreme Court justices or lower court justices. It comes up once in a while, but not very often. We don't really talk a lot about declaring war or the lack of declarations of war in the last 40, 50, 60, 70 years. What we talk a lot about now are jobs. They're being talked about a lot. In what way can a president help create or actually create jobs?
Well, I think that there are some things that could be done in the short run, positive or negative. Despite the rhetoric that we've heard, the stimulus that was passed at the beginning of the Obama administration did have a short run positive effect on the economy. If you look at Europe and some of the austerity programs that are being enforced on countries like Greece and Spain, that has a short term negative impact. It may have a long term good.
And Paul Krugman, writing today in the paper, suggests that the Republicans are wrong and that if Mitt Romney gets elected, we should be worried because he wants to go down the Europe path, be less involved and be more austere, and that's the exact wrong way to go. So is that where they affect?
Yeah, and I wanted to say in the long term, there are so many forces that buffet the economy, from global forces to, you know, natural disasters to any number of things. It's very hard for a president to control kind of the broad economy.
Well, in fact, in the last debate, Mitt Romney said government doesn't create jobs. And then, surprisingly, President Obama agreed with him. But doesn't government create jobs? I mean, if you eliminate the Department of Education, how many jobs go out the window with that?
Mitt Romney also followed it up by saying, and I will create 12 million jobs if I become president. But that would be what we would expect with growth apace now, 12 million more jobs created. They're talking about slightly different things here. Government, in a literal sense, does create jobs with federal employees and the people that have to administer the government to provide services to folks. On the other side, the argument goes government doesn't create jobs in the broader – other than those jobs, and it only gets in the way through regulations. Mm-hmm. And so the argument goes – the president has the power to create jobs by getting out of the way of entrepreneurs. And the flip side is the president has the power to keep a stable economy going with jobs by regulating so that we don't have another financial meltdown and loss of jobs. So that's a philosophical difference about the role a president can play.
Can those policies that regulate or not regulate, that create jobs or not create jobs, that encourage entrepreneurship or not encourage, can they emanate from the Congress? Or do they have to emanate from the executive branch and be approved by the Congress?
I think it's both.
It's both.
So when the Congress
probably has more power.
Well, then why doesn't the Congress do it? They're complaining about it. Why don't they do it?
Well, I mean, in this particular case, because the president has a veto pen that he can veto things. If you remember the
yes, but the president can suggest legislation that dies instantly.
Mm-hmm. Sure yes. enough. But if you remember during the Clinton administration, one of the reasons the government shut down was the Republican Congress was passing things that Bill Clinton said, I'm not going to sign, and I am going to take the government down. And he ultimately won that battle and won the reelection. So the Congress power to forge economic policy has to go through the president, you know, one way or the other. And, you know, that's why they can't just kind of do it unilaterally.
How much of it has to do with the Congress doesn't want the blame?
That's the major part of it. That's why we have the fiscal cliff that's coming, because Congress pushed the issue. We haven't had a budget. They pushed the issue until after the election.
And yeah, and then they'll rush in, irrespective of the results, they'll have to rush in and do something after the election. I think a lot of it goes back to the lack of understanding of the – it's very difficult and they shouldn't be faulted. But all these things we're talking about, how many jobs did the stimulus create? It clearly created jobs, but the conservatives say yes, but at what cost? Or more could have been created another way. The fact that The creation of jobs from these things is not a primary, incident. It's not that, okay, here's money for a job, hire somebody. It's a secondary or tertiary impact. These are often externalities of policies. And so the average voter is sitting there scratching their head, okay, they did that policy. How do I figure out exactly how many jobs were created or lost? And there's no clear answer to that. And that leads the public to great confusion.
Well, an economist can't prove the secondary and tertiary effects of legislation on how many jobs are created, which then frees both sides to make up numbers.
To argue that that their side's right.
We hear some politicians talking a lot about how government needs to be run more like a business. And executive experience is one of the things that Mitt Romney talks a lot about, his executive experience. But executives can appoint their own department heads. Executives can make decisions about who they want to hire or who they want to fire to help them run or not run the company. A president has to get all of this through the Congress. They have to get all of their key appointments approved by Congress. And Congress can reject those choices and, in fact, have rejected those choices. Is that an indication that the founding fathers didn't see government as a business or couldn't even have anticipated that anyone would see it as a business?
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly as a modern corporation, they would have no sense of that. And you're exactly right. I think that's the fundamental difference, that a president has to negotiate, compromise, work with the Congress. A business person does not have to do that. You know, he can say, you're fired. I don't want you here anymore. And again, you know, if you look at the historical record, I can't think of right off the top of my head anybody who was considered to be a good to great president who had much business experience at all. Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Delano Roosevelt,
Is it because the government is populated by lawyers and not by business people, and therefore a business person confronting all these lawyers?
Well, it's not just that. There's two points. First off, you know, as John talked earlier, because we're a system of shared power, You have to convince others. And this was the point you just made. And there's a scholar named Richard Neustadt who said the true power of the president is the power to persuade. You can be a powerful president if you're able to persuade Congress and others to go along with you. But I'd also like to add that your listeners included and everybody would be a little upset if government were run like a business in certain ways. And let me explain one simple way, citywide, this is true. People, and you're going to get letters for this. People pay too little in property taxes. It's the most hated tax out there.
I'm writing the first letter.
You write the first letter. Your property taxes are through the roof, and yet they do not cover the services you get from a city. In the city I live in, I think it's something like almost $1.80 in services. You know, you're talking water, fire, police, $1.80 in services for every dollar paid in taxes. That's not good business. So you know what they do? They have to shaft somebody else. Do you know who gets shafted on property taxes? Small businesses. For every dollar they pay in property taxes, they get less than $1 in services. Now, if you had to run everything like a real business, you would seek a parity point with that. But businesses don't vote, but homeowners do. So, you know, you can't necessarily run everything like a business when you're government, and it doesn't
work in
the same way. Well,
that's interesting because we keep hearing that corporations are people, and we also, at the federal level, we hear about this incredible influence of dollars coming in from special interest groups, many of which are run by corporate heads. And yet it's the people who vote. The people don't seem to have any voice in this because we don't have the collective bargaining power that these corporations do with members of Congress and the president. Something's out of whack here.
Mm-hmm. Well, McCain-Feingold, ostensibly was going to limit some of that impact. Right. And obviously in the decision that came after the Citizens United decision said, oh, those limits don't necessarily apply. And John McCain himself is fired up about that.
What can presidents do about gas prices?
Very little. and that came out in the debate. I mean, you know, Mitt Romney was criticizing President Obama for gas prices being, you know, well above what they were when he came into office. And the point being, we were in economic, you know, decline. That's why they were low. But there are so many, again, globalized forces. You know, there's higher demand from China and India as their economies grow. There are sanctions on Iran, which I think everybody would agree that we need sanctions on Iran. There are disruptions in pipeline for because of natural events. It's very hard to pin either good or bad on gas prices on a president.
You're also dealing with these enormous multinational oil companies. Shell Oil may be an American brand, but it is not an American company.
And the president, you have to remember that the Democrats were lobbing these at George W. Bush when George W. Bush had no control over gas prices, and the Republicans are lobbing them.
So,
Obama, but it's a global market. A president cannot influence a global market.
But what about allowing drilling on federal land?
We don't have an oil problem in the U.S. We have a gasoline refining problem. We have an issue with refineries. We have too few refineries.
How is
backed up.
All right, and how is that a government problem? Why isn't that a corporate problem? And why aren't the corporations putting in more refineries because they can charge more for gasoline because they don't have the refineries?
Right. These are corporations like Exxon that make $40 billion a year in profits. They could afford. They could expand if they wanted to.
Okay. Bob writes, please discuss the president's power in not implementing the law and whether this is appropriate for the executive, as in DOMA, immigration laws, etc.
Well, I think here's an area, where – some people sometimes say, well, it doesn't matter who gets elected. In these kinds of areas, it matters very much, especially with regard to the DREAM Act. It was blocked by Congress by a filibuster. And President Obama basically over the summer, his administration said, well, we're going to reinterpret this law so that we're not going to deport people who have been here for a long time. Mitt Romney could very easily change that policy. I'm not saying he will or he won't. On Defense of Marriage Act, the Obama administration has said, we are not going to fight this in court. I think in that particular instance, they're on pretty strong ground. Nothing compels their administration to fight for a law that they don't agree with. But I think in those kinds of things that can be done and undone very quickly, that's where some of the big differences are between the candidates.
So in the 1 minute we have less than a minute, what should voters consider when they make their choice for president? Should they consider gas prices, jobs, support for Israel, etc.? And could their choice actually influence any of those things that we keep hearing about constantly in this campaign over and over?
Well, most people are, I think, retrospective voters. They tend to think, I'm going to reward the party in power if things are good or improving from where they were. I'm going to punish the party in power. People need to think of how they feel, interpret the economy, but no, not on gas prices, not on things like that.
Dr. Scott Huffman with Winthrop University. Anybody else want to chime in 10 seconds or less? Okay. Dr. John Schmier, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Mark Kelso, Professor and Chair of Political Science and International Studies at Queen's University of Charlotte. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.